From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
I just believe that if you actually focus on building a culture, that's the first step. If you invest as much time into caring about the culture of working in your restaurant as you do the food and the wine and the service you give to your guest.
What would you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail? It's the mantra of Will Guidera. Along with Chef Daniel Hume, he's the restaurateur behind 11 Madison Park, voted the top restaurant in the world last year. He also co-masterminds the Nomad Hotel and Bar in New York, which just came to downtown LA. Will's been sharing some wisdom he learned from his dad and how it shapes his ideas about hospitality.
Choose what you want to accomplish, not based on whether or not you think it's possible to accomplish it, but what do you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail? Answer that question and then try to do that. He gave me a paperweight with that quote on it when I was really young, and it's every time someone joins our company, we give them a card with that quote on it.
What really strikes me about those of you who are coming out from New York to LA, you're in a bit of a different position because you've actually lived out here before. Who did you work for when you were out here the first time around?
Well, so my dad used to run a company called Restaurant Associates in New York. And when I was a junior in high school, he moved out to be the CEO of the Wolfgang Puck Food Company. So that wasn't the company that ran Spago. They did all the expresses and the cafes and that entire suite of restaurants and products. And so I never lived out here full time, but I was here every summer during my, you know, winter breaks. And so I was a line cook at Aubergine, Wolfgang's restaurant on, I think it was Cannon. And then I was a busboy at Spago in Beverly Hills. And we lived here in Santa Monica, actually. And yeah, I mean, that's when I fell in love with this place. I loved being a busboy at Spago. Just, you know, I mean, for a kid who, from the age of 12, wanted to be in the restaurant business, getting to bus tables at Spago, it's like a dream come true. I think I was 16 or 17 years old. And
did that solidify your love of the front of the house rather than...
Well, I always wanted to be in the dining room. I never wanted to work in the kitchen. I worked as a line cook at Aubergine only because, and I did, I worked as an accountant, I've worked as a purchaser, as a cook, only because I wanted to understand the entire business so I could succeed in the path that I chose. But for me, the dining room was always where I wanted to be. I love the ability to create those magical experiences for people that walk through our doors. And in the dining room, you get the instant gratification of looking at the expression on people's faces when you create them. And so, no, that didn't solidify it. It had already been solidified. But I think every job I've had since I started down this path just got me more excited to do what I'm doing.
So you have this 3-star Michelin restaurant in New York that's been named the number one restaurant in the world. And I think about the kind of service and the attention to detail and the level of perfection involved in that kind of an enterprise. And then I think about the way most of us eat, not even saying the word dine, but the way most of us eat here in Los Angeles, it's a very, very different culture. Have you thought about, I mean, you must have thought about the impression of diners and what you're hoping to bring to them? And if you're importing a New York culture, are you creating something new?
Well, so Nomad, even in New York, is very different from what 11 Madison Park is. Each one of our restaurants is meant to hold some place in people's lives. If 11 Madison Park is where you go once a year, perhaps to celebrate an amazing moment or to give yourself the grace to forget a difficult one, Nomad was always meant for us to be our perfect night out on the town, a place where, you know, it had the same pursuit of excellence and hospitality as 11 Madison Park, but was louder, looser. We have musical inspirations for our restaurants. 11 Madison Park is Miles Davis. The Nomad is the Rolling Stones. And I think that helps to explain it. There was always a distinction between those two restaurants. When we brought Nomad out here, we never intended for it to be a carbon copy of New York. I think there's a balance there. We want to add something to the conversation of restaurants in Los Angeles, but we also want Los Angeles to add something to the conversation of the restaurants in our company. we want to bring a little bit of New York with us, but we didn't just decide to open another restaurant. We decided we wanted to be in Los Angeles, and then we brought Nomad here.
It's interesting, too, that you started, like, your public face in L.A. was a truck.
Yeah. Well, no, I think we did that for a few reasons. I think French chefs coming to New York is the equivalent of New York restaurateurs coming to Los Angeles in the sense that people come in with all this bravado and thinking, we're going to teach you how it's done, and that's just not how we feel at all.
We tend to spit out people who do that.
Yeah, and I think understandably so. We wanted to humbly introduce ourselves to the city. We wanted to get to know the city, and I think one of the main parts about the truck was giving ourselves the opportunity to collaborate with so many amazing chefs and restaurateurs out here. You know, I love what we do because of the community that exists in our industry. And it just seemed impossible to us, the idea of opening a restaurant out here without first having spent a year with our team out here getting to know the people and the places. And we also knew that, and whatever success we've gained in New York, that doesn't mean anyone out here knows who we are. And it was so funny, a couple times some people would say to our team running the truck, hey, this is pretty cool. You guys should open a brick and mortar. And we were like, all right, this was definitely the right thing to do. But it was a really enriching experience, and I'm so happy that we did it.
You know, I watched the Welcome Conference presentation that Ewan and Daniel did, who's your partner in the business. Your friendship is so apparent. It's so palpable. You nearly find a kind of marital delight in one another, which is so rare. How much of your success in retooling the business when the two of you came together do you attribute to the fact that you found one another?
I think 100% of our success. Daniel is my business partner. He's my best friend. He has siblings, but there was a pretty significant age gap between him and his siblings, and so he was kind of like an only child as well. And so the two of us are as close to being brothers to one another than we've had. You know, early on, when we first met, we talked about what we wanted in our relationship and in the restaurant. I used to want to be in fine dining for a long time, but I stopped wanting to be in fine dining because I had spent my life pursuing the craft of service, and I found myself in a chef-driven industry running around trying to convince the person in the back that what I cared about mattered as much as what he or she cared about. And when Daniel and I met, we decided that the best way to run the restaurant was from both sides of the wall. Inevitably, a restaurateur-driven restaurant will make decisions based on what's best for the dining room. A chef-driven restaurant will make those same decisions based on what's best for the kitchen. But if it's 50-50, with all the tension that inevitably comes with that type of partnership, you make decisions based on what's best for the restaurant as a whole. We say often that when our relationship is strong, when the two of us are in a really good place, the company is a better company. But it is like a marriage in the sense that it's not easy. You know, I think restaurants are about relationships. Relationships are based on trust. And you can only have a consistent foundation of trust if you're constantly pursuing each other. I mean, with our team, one of the things we say is, ideally, if we've done a good job in hiring you, we are all aligned in the sense that we want to create the best experience we can. But invariably, we don't all agree on how to do that. And disagreement is where tension occurs. And rather than being frustrated by it, we believe that you should embrace it because it just means the other person cares as much as you do. And if you don't turn away when those moments arise, but rather you turn towards one another and you process through them, that's when the biggest opportunities for growth as human beings can occur. And so, you know, with Daniel and I, the rule is don't go to bed angry. You referenced a marital thing. I mean, it's the same exact thing. I believe if you focus on relationships with your colleagues in the same way that you focus on the relationships in your life, that it's pretty amazing what you can get out of them.
How many employees are at the Nomad just in food and beverage?
About 300.
That's extraordinary. You know, so many chefs in town are talking about how difficult it is to find people in Los Angeles now. Is it challenging to work with a pool of people that their life aspirations are elsewhere? Or do you feel like you're offering an opportunity for people to find a path as professional food and beverage people?
I celebrate people who have different aspirations working within our walls because they each bring with them a unique perspective. And if it's just a bunch of restaurant nerds running a restaurant, I don't think it's ever going to be nearly as good as if you have a bunch of different people from different walks of life with different passions. And some of them, and this has been the case at our restaurants in New York for the past 10 years, have fallen in love with what we do and have changed the course of their careers to commit themselves to it. For others, the message that we try to send is, hey, even if this isn't what you want to do for a living, we just ask that you care about it when you're here. We don't need all of you. We just need all of you when you're with us, because we need to respect that people are trusting us with their time and their money, and that's not only a responsibility, but it's an opportunity. I believe that creating amazing experiences for people when they walk through our doors is one of the most affirming and uplifting and energizing things. I believe in the nobility of serving other people, and if we can find other people, whether they want to be actors or whatever, who also are energized by those exchanges, that's all that really matters.
That's Will Guidera. He and Chef Daniel Hume just opened Nomad Hotel and Bar in downtown L.A. They're the team behind the number one restaurant in the world, 11 Madison Park. Coming up, an on-the-ground report from the Mexican state of Oaxaca, the heart of mezcal country. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. I'm sure you've been seeing a lot more mezcal at cocktail bars lately. It's a distilled alcohol made from the agave plant with a taste that's often described as earthy, complex, and smoky. Now it's a booming industry, thanks in part to surging U.S. demand. Our former supervising producer, Jillian Ferguson, recently visited Oaxaca, where over 70% of the world's mezcal is produced. Business is good, but it's also causing some to worry.
There's a point on the highway, in between Oaxaca City and the town of Miahuatlan, 2 hours to the south, where the road just ends, and our car hurtles from a perfectly paved surface into what looks like a construction pit.
Oh, wow. Rough.
They've been trying to build this road, like, from 20 years now. And what happens is that they steal the money. Oops. And they just left the mess as it is.
I'm in the car with Silvia Filion, a Mexico City native who moved to Oaxaca over a decade ago after she fell deeply in love with mezcal. Not that worm-in-the-bottle stuff you see at duty-free in the airport, but traditional mezcal, the kind of small-batch spirit that's been made for generations in rural communities like Miahuatlan, a tiny town in the Sierra Sur where we're headed right now. As we snake through the hillsides, Sylvia points out agave, growing wild on the side of the road.
Miahuatlan is the land of Karwinskis. See, you can see Karwinskis over there. So the flavors of mezcales in this region is very grassy, green, floral.
Sylvia is the general director of Mezcaloteca. It's a small tasting room in Oaxaca City dedicated to preserving the tradition of mezcal and the biodiversity of agave. She and her team work with 45 different maestro, or master, mezcaleros across 8 Mexican states. And each of their mezcals tastes wildly different. Some are herbal, they're spicy, and others taste like chocolate or even Parmesan.
Sometimes when you drink a mezcal from Miahuatlan that tastes like chiles, you wonder where the flavor of the chiles comes from. And it comes from the plant growing near chiles every year.
Just like wine, mezcal is all about terroir. The flavor depends on the type of agave, where it was grown, who produced it, how it was distilled. And it is not, as is often said, the smoky cousin of tequila. It's more like tequila's grandfather, because before it was commercialized, tequila was just one type of mezcal. See, the word mezcal in the traditional sense just means a distillate made from agave. And historically, it was produced all over Mexico, including a little town in the state of Jalisco called Tequila. It was there in 1795 that the Spanish awarded the first permit to distill mezcal to a family by the name of Cuervo.
When Cuervo starts to produce mezcal in the region of Tequila, it became popular in all the country. And they took away the word mezcal, and they were calling it with the generic of tequila.
The drink goes on to international fame, and in the 1970s, the region is awarded the first designation of origin, or DO, outside of Europe. So just like there are rules to protect champagne or Roquefort cheese, the Mexican government created its own protections for tequila that said it could only be produced with one type of agave, the fast-growing Blue Weber. Mezcal also has its own protected status. Only 9 states can legally call their product mezcal. But unlike tequila, it can be made with more than 30 varieties of agave. And as we drive through the countryside, you can see all that diversity on the side of the road. Some are crested with blue and green spikes, and others grow tall and crooked, like something from a Dr. Seuss book. Oaxaca is the epicenter of the world's biodiversity in agave, and Sylvia's mission is to keep it that way. Our first stop in Miahuatlán is Victor Ramos's Palenque, a traditional outdoor distillery surrounded by fields of agave, corn, beans, and squash. 3 generations have made mezcal here on this hillside.
The fathers teach the sons when they're kids, 9, 10 years old, because making traditional mezcal is a family labor. All the tíos and primos and sobrinos come to help because it's a lot of work.
At these traditional palenques, nothing is automated. The agave hearts, or piñas, are roasted in an earth oven for up to a week, giving it that signature smoky flavor. Then they're smashed by hand with a wooden mallet or crushed by a big stone wheel pulled by farm animals. Then the mash is fermented in open-air barrels and distilled over wood fire in clay or copper pots. There are no temperature dials, no timers to set. It's all done by feel, which is why people insist that you can actually taste the hand of the maker in every batch. Sylvia has helped Victor bottle a few small batches for export to the U.S., and sales have been good enough that his son Manuel decided to quit his job working as a carpenter at the local prison and go back to being a maestro mezcalero.
This is a reality. We're giving jobs to all these maestros mezcaleros and their sons, and that's amazing because they can stay to produce mezcal, and we're also paying fair prices. So that's very important for them to make good money.
The Ramos family is one success story of the mezcal boom that has swept through Mexico and into major North American cities like Los Angeles, Chicago, and San Francisco, which is home to the largest mezcal tasting in the country, called Mexico in a Bottle. It was there that I met Hugo Gonzalez, who lives in Oakland but grew up in Mexico City, at a time when mezcal had a pretty dodgy reputation.
Mezcal, it was not good, you know, like, it was for the lower class, you know, like, for the poor people. And now it's fancy, you know, and I don't know if it's good to say, but, like, kind of, like, hipster, you know?
In Mexico, it's only been hip for about a decade. And here in the States, the trend is much younger. When Susan Koss launched Mexico in a Bottle 6 years ago, she was practically begging people to come.
You know, we were pushing people to please buy tickets. Oh, my God, we're going to have the most amazing mezcals.
And now demand is through the roof. Susan quit her day job so she could take Mexico in a Bottle on the road. And now she's selling out events in New York, Chicago, Denver, and D.C. But the rise in popularity puts mezcal at a crossroads. In the last 2 years, 3 of the world's largest spirits companies, the same multinationals that own brands like Johnny Walker, Absolut, and Grey Goose, they all invested heavily in mezcal brands, suggesting that mezcal is ready to go big, which makes fans like Susan a little apprehensive.
When you look at the history of tequila, how it became a commodity in the world market, that because of demand and the increase in the volume of production, it lost a little bit of its essence and soul through that.
Before tequila went global, Jalisco was home to 10 species of agave, but they took a long time to grow and couldn't be used to make tequila. So they disappeared, leaving behind only one, the Blue Weber. In an effort to scale faster, growers started cloning the agave instead of planting from seed, which weakens the plant and leaves it vulnerable to disease and pests. And for years, Jalisco has struggled with agave shortages. Back in Miahuatlán, we visited a second maestro mezcalero named Felipe Cortez, who also sells his mezcal through Silvia at Mezcaloteca. He tells us that other brands who are exporting his product aren't paying fair prices, and that buyers from Tequila have offered him a lot of money for his agave, which makes it hard for him to say no. And these market realities are deeply concerning to Silvia.
They have a lot of problems with the monocultivation of blue agave, so they are actually not respecting the deal of tequila, and they're coming to Oaxaca to buy plants.
And it's not just the tequileros that are driving prices up. Demand for agave syrup is another culprit. And as the mezcal industry in Oaxaca grows, so does competition for these plants, which is why activists like Silvia are encouraging the maestro mezcaleros to plan for the future by building greenhouses. She shows me one example back at Victor Ramos's place.
You can see here that they are growing espadines, but these espadines are growing by seed.
Silvia says about 30% of the maestro mezcaleros she works with keep greenhouses. Others have to rely on plants from local farmers, but the marketplace is competitive. And if the small producers can't find plants or space in the marketplace, Silvia says we lose a lot more than a delicious sip of mezcal.
We lose the tradition of mezcal. We lose a big story for Mexico. How people live, what do they do with their hands, what do they like to create, to produce. It's not just a drink that's going to get you drunk and you're going to have a nice night. This is culture of Mexico, and it's what farmers in Mexico live every day.
As one maestro mezcalero told me,
nosotros somos mezcal. Es nuestra bebida. Esta cosa es nuestra vida, ¿me entiendes? Esa era de nuestros antepasados.
We are mezcal. It's our drink. It's our life. It's our ancestors. For Good Food, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
Our thanks to Jillian Ferguson. This piece was made with support from KCRW's Independent Producer Project.
And what I found was an incredibly raw, vulnerable population, unbelievably eager to not screw up their second chance.
That's filmmaker Thomas Lennon. He's talking to me about Edwin's Leadership and Restaurant Institute in Cleveland, Ohio. Edwin's teaches formerly incarcerated men and women to cook and serve classical French cuisine in a fine dining restaurant. Nearly all the trainees have never set foot in a professional kitchen before. Last year, Lennon released his film about Edwin's opening. The film is called Knife Skills, and it recently earned an Oscar nomination. Thomas Lennon joins me with Edwin's founder and CEO, Brandon Krostowski. So, Brandon, maybe you can just tell us a bit of the background. How many inmates are released from prison each year?
Yeah, so in the state of Ohio, we have about 22,000 that are released each year. In our county alone, the county of Cuyahoga, we have anywhere between 4 and 6,000. Sometimes it's these tracking, tracking someone who's leaving incarceration isn't the easiest. Nationwide, you're leaving 650,000 people come home. So it's
every year, which comes to like 2,000 people every day, and it's a huge undertaking too.
What is it about restaurants and kitchens, do you think, that makes them such good environments for the formerly incarcerated to have some success and reenter society?
Yeah, and there's a couple of reasons. One, most of us, I think, at the helms of a restaurant or in a position are from a tattered background. We've certainly experienced loss. We've certainly experienced some sort of malfunction in life. So I think that's in the DNA of somebody who's running or owning a restaurant. Two, it's one of these industries where you're allowed to, hard work doesn't have a language. So in this business, it's easy to speak with how you feel through hard work. So, if you're foreign, if you come from a different past, it doesn't affect the work ethic. So I think those two are really the two big reasons why this industry is so accessible. And plus, you need hard workers who want it, that are gritty and that are looking to work hard.
Talk a little bit, Brandon, about how the funnel works. What percentage who start with the initial program end up at the end of it with a job in another restaurant?
First of all, we don't ask what someone's previous offense was or education level. If someone comes to us, they say, hey, I want an opportunity, we lend that to them, and it's theirs to lose. We lose about 50% those first 3 weeks when we're teaching some of the fundamentals besides serve safe, menu knowledge, culinary math, et cetera. Once that is passed, we'll lose maybe 20% more. But those who finish the program stay in this industry. We got 98% of our graduates stay in the business. And then those who graduate have a waiting list of 50 jobs who want to hire them. So the employment rate is off the scale. If you want it, it's yours.
You worked for chefs like Charlie Trotter, and you worked at Le Cirque in New York. Why did you leave fine dining? And what was the series of events that led you to found Edwin's? How did you think that it was possible to do?
Well, it happened in my life. You know, I tell everyone this is a story of my life, and I wouldn't put anyone through it unless I went through it myself. And that's part of the success of this. Is it's you know, when someone wavers or struggles, I can feel where that is, and because I felt it myself. You know, I got arrested when I was younger. I was 18, thrown in jail, facing 5 to 10 years in prison. The judge gives me probation. I met a chef in downtown Detroit who mentored me. His lessons got me out of that city. They kept me out of jail. Well, for a little bit, but I mean, enough to realize that you got to grow up. From there, I had a taste of success. I got a taste of what it's like to win. And I worked under Charlie Trotter, who grew me for just that. You know, even in Paris, you know, this Alain Cendrons, who just passed recently in the actually 2 years ago, another philosopher, but just everyone had this idea that food was more than just nourishment. Trotter was a huge believer that the food can do and transcend things. Cendrons was the first person in France to pair wines with each course. He was a thinker. He was always, his finger was always on his chin in every picture. The pedigree I came from was that of thinkers. And when I started really working hard in New York at Le Cirque, I got a phone call and another phone call from back home in Detroit about someone who was either killed or put in prison. And I couldn't help but think, I'm here with these copper pots and these magnificent wines, and someone's not. So if I have breath in my lungs, I need to pay this back. And that's what I started doing. I just started learning different aspects of the restaurant business, you know, through the wall talks at Chanterelle. I went back to the CIA and wrote a business plan.
That's the Culinary Institute, not the
Correct.
Central Intelligence. Yeah.
And just kept just pounding away at this dream, and for 10 years,
because I was going to say that I just met someone last week who knew Brandon back in 2003, 2004, and he told me that Brandon was already talking then mm-hmm. about this kind of a restaurant where the staff was formerly incarcerated. So this is a thought that had been in him for a long, long time.
But the basic premise was a break, and then a skill set that allows you to succeed. Then just winning, and then using those wins for the power of good.
And I have to ask you this, Tom. As you were watching what was going on around you, could you see who the people were that were just completely engaged?
I actually found that most people were incredibly engaged, including, by the way, a lot of people who then dropped out or got into some situation where they, you know, some other thing, some other demand on their time or some kind of dumb argument or whatever. I was so unprepared. I just sort of stumbled into this story. I didn't come from a criminal justice background. I just met Brandon when he was, very fortunately, I met him when he was just about to start. So I was able to do those first few crazy weeks when he was starting. And so I brought just typical kind of misconceptions about what former inmates are going to be like. And I expected a very tough crowd. And I spent time thinking about how I was going to protect my equipment when I arrived there and so on and so forth. But they really felt that this was an opportunity. And I found most people engaged. Obviously, some learned faster than others and some people kind of broke out as stars. I wasn't trying to find the stars. I was trying to find the people who had real stories to tell, and of which there were an embarrassment of riches. I did 4 or 5 profiles. I could have done 20 more.
Now, the film was shot in 2014 when Edwin's was first opening. From the beginning of the film, when you realize that, Brandon, you have thrown down this gauntlet, put together these resources, and you have a 6-week window to take these people to open for the very first time, not just a 6-week training for the fourth cohort that's coming through. Some people would say that you were completely nuts.
Starting with the filmmaker.
you wouldn't be the first. I'd throw back to you, Jimmy. Do you doubt the fact of a human being who desires to improve, that if given the tools and a clean slate, they can't? And to me, that was always the question to ask myself in the hole that I took myself out of and said, hey, once I had a chance, once it was fair and equal, it was possible. And there's no doubt in my mind that the group of men and women that we began with were going to make this happen.
I was biting my nails. And I was calling home every night because I hadn't really fully made a commitment to make the film. I just was shooting. And then I called my wife and say, you know, this guy, I don't know what he's thinking of. He's got some sort of Jesus complex. He thinks he's going to turn all these people's lives around in 6 weeks. And then the next day I'd call back and say, God, what's going on? He was amazing. So it was like a real roller coaster ride. And actually a number of his own staff, they didn't take on Brandon because weren't too eager to face him down straight up. But they were coming to me and going like, this is nuts. We're not going to be ready. We're not going to be ready. And of course, that kind of chaos for me as a filmmaker is fun. It's interesting. But it was, even I started biting my nails.
How has Edwin's been doing since the film was shot?
Good. In 2015, decided that housing was a need. So went out and got 3 buildings and figured out housing. So now we have a campus. We have a fitness center, library, test kitchen, free student dorms, paid for alumni housing. Just got another building, which will be a butcher shop eventually to fine or hone our skills of meat cutlery. It's doing well because, one, it's a great product, and two, there's a great community behind it. We'll be at the James Beard next week here in New York.
Let me just say, I was very eager to show that I was completely independent, so I would never take any of their food. I would go across the street to the coffee shop to eat because I wanted no financial relationship between me and the restaurant. But I finally started eating there. It's delicious. It's really good food. If you're in Cleveland, you got to go.
So where can we see the film?
Keep your fingers crossed. It's not widely available yet. It's sort of been in its building, its reputation phase. It'll roll out one of these days. Please be rooting for us, all right?
Oh, definitely. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure.
That's filmmaker Thomas Lennon and Edwin's founder, Brandon Krestowski. We've been talking about Knife Skills, which is the name of Lennon's documentary short about Edwin's. The film is currently up for an Oscar. In a moment, a look at the mainstreaming of hippie food. That's when Good Food continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're back. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. When I was 14, I learned to make loaves of bread so heavy, it was a miracle they could be chewed. I never thought that foods emblematic of that era could one day be signifiers of health, class, and style. Foods like tofu, sprouts, brown rice, and those whole grain breads.
I knew a lot of us had these memories about all of these foods, and I had never bothered to think about where they came from until a few years ago.
That's food writer Jonathan Kaufman. We've been talking about how formerly fringe foods became part of the American diet. It's the story of his new book called Hippie Food. This is really an extraordinary document. It could be my food memoir. Did this food start in the 60s, or were there precursors? I'm thinking about Adele Davis.
Yeah, there. In fact, there's actually a long history of health food in America that dates back to the mid-19th century and people like Sylvester Graham, who we know because of the name Graham Crackers. But really, the health food scene in Southern California, especially from the 1920s to the 1950s, introduced a lot of the foods that we now associate with hippies.
Foods like what?
Foods like sprouts, smoothies, a lot of fruit juices. A carob also was something that Angelenos began eating in the 1920s.
We have to talk about carob because I had a hippie boyfriend, like a super hippie boyfriend, who as we would just walk around the city, he would stop and he would graze at carob trees. This is not a food that is inherently delicious.
No, it really isn't. I think it was a subsistence food. It is a subsistence food in parts of the Mediterranean because it grows well in desert climates. And so in the 1910s, I think, there were agricultural experiments in Southern California to plant carob trees, thinking that they would get, you know, sort of use them as a sweetener or make syrups out of the carob pods.
But alas, they were too dry and disgusting to do that with.
Yes, unfortunately, in the 1930s, they also discovered that they sort of tasted like chocolate. And so health food stores started selling these carob sweets, and that idea caught on.
I just feel like so much of this food in its initial coming forth was just so undelicious.
Yeah, it really was. When I looked at the cookbooks from the late 1960s and even a little bit the early 70s, I wasn't really tempted to make the food because they seemed very simple, very dour. I heard lots of stories of bean and sprout casseroles. It really wasn't until the mid-70s when people like Anna Thomas and Molly Katzen and cooks like them really created a much more colorful, internationally influenced cuisine.
So let's talk about that. You talk about the summer of 1970 and what was going on that caused a deluge of young people to fly all over the place.
So in the late 60s, the airline industry across the United States spent millions and millions of dollars on upgrading both airlines and airports to accommodate jumbo jets. And they increased the capacity for travel, and then they had to fill the planes. And so they started offering all of these cheap fares to Europe. And you could actually take a flight where they would serve margaritas and play rock and roll, or you could fly to Iceland for $99 and then get across to the continent. And traveling to Europe became a middle class, a rite of passage for a lot of college kids.
I had a ticket that lasted a year for $120.
Wow.
In 1970.
And, you know, you had all these kids piling into European countries and like sleeping on lawns and, you know, clumping up in squares, smoking marijuana. And in the governments of these countries didn't even know what to do with all of the young Americans who were kind of taking over the cities.
This group of kids managed to start foraging ingredients that still today are sort of markers of simple European eating in a way that has tremendous cachet. It's just so odd.
Yeah, I think because they were so poor, or they were just traveling on the cheap, they really were eating the food that was around them, and they fell for, you know, the farmers markets or, you know, find just the pleasures of simple, good bread, where previous generations of Americans or even their parents would have traveled to hotels and been kind of removed from the food of the countries around them.
Let's go back to talk a little bit about sort of the organic triumvirate, not meaning organic the way we think of it today, but let's talk about tofu for a minute and politics. What was the role that tofu played?
Well, tofu has been made in California since the mid-19th century, but it largely stayed in Japanese and Chinese American communities. In 1971, a UC Berkeley student named Francis Moore LePay dropped out of school in order to research this problem of poverty. She was really concerned about the roots of poverty and started studying agricultural reports to see if America could feed itself in the face of famine or if the world could. And she discovered that we were feeding huge amounts of corn and grain and soybeans to animals instead of people. And that in fact, if we just went vegetarian, it could eradicate global famine.
This sounds so familiar. doesn't it?
Oh, we're still hearing, yeah, we're hearing this rhetoric again today with Beyond Meat and Impossible Burger folks who are trying to come up with these good-tasting meat substitutes. So for her, soybeans were kind of the perfect vegetable protein. William Shurtleff and Akiko Ayagi, who were living in Japan, decided that tofu would be kind of this food that could feed the world. And so they researched and wrote a book called The Book of Tofu, and then spent 6 months traveling around the United States. And every place they stopped to give a presentation about tofu, a small tofu making collective set up.
That's extraordinary. So what's really fascinating to me are how these foods sort of switched from being these marginalized, degraded foods by the larger culture, and yet became totally embedded in the food culture, the mass market food culture.
I think part of that is because they stuck around. It was this sort of longevity. And so generations like me, who grew up with them a little bit and may have poo-pooed them and kind of moved away from them for a time, came back to them later. But also, what really became clear as I was researching the book is that the ideas about what healthy food was that emerged in the 1970s became the template that everyone adopted. You know, in 1970, nutritionists were saying, "Oh, whole wheat bread and white bread have, you know, they're about the same amount. They're both good for you as long as you eat a balanced diet." And now the USDA is recommending that we get half of our grains from whole grains.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've learned how to make those breads a lot more deliciously.
Yes. When I eat tartine bread, and it's made by Tartine Bakery, and it's just this beautiful, light, airy, flavorful sourdough bread that's really crusty. Oh, I love it. It's my favorite.
So let's talk about money and government and the word organic. Eventually, this word organic morphed and started to mean something. What kind of money was there to be made in the organic agriculture business?
There was very little money at the beginning. It was very much a fringe pursuit from the 1940s, when the term organic was introduced by J.I. Rodale to the United States, to the 1970s, when Back to the Landers moved to rural areas. And because they had these ideas, these interests in natural food and avoiding pesticides, they began farming organically and buying organic produce. But it was very much a small thing where, you know, if you were a farmer, you were sort of selling to a niche group of people like you. It wasn't until the 90s when the USDA adopted, you know, organic certification standards, and people began realizing you could make a lot of money by charging a premium for organic produce, that, you know, the industry took off.
So when you walk into a Whole Foods or a Sprouts today, these grocery chains that focus on natural foods, what do you think when you walk through them?
I think about how much money is involved in this industry now, that, and it was such a ragtag affair for so many years. I'm really also impressed at how many products they have. Organic food or natural foods was such a small industry back in the 1970s. In fact, they didn't like a lot of processed food. And now we have so many different kinds of vegetables, so many different kinds of processed foods, so many, you know, so many things for sale. It looks much more appetizing than I think a 1975 co-op would have looked.
Jonathan Kaufman is a food writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. His new book is Hippie Food: How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. After the break, we're talking dates at the farmer's market, plus Jonathan Gold. Don't go anywhere.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. And now, a visit to the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Here's market correspondent Laura Avery.
We're here at the market enjoying a beautiful sunny day, meeting a new chef I have not met before myself, Chef Daniele Uditi, who is chef owner at Pizzana, pizza restaurant in Brentwood. And you are Italian.
Yes, I am.
And I guess the first question we always want to know, is it Neapolitan style? Tell us about your pizza.
Well, what we try to do at Pizzana, and first of all, hi guys, everybody. So what we're trying to do at Pizzana is something new, something different. You know, everybody does Neapolitan style, Neapolitan pizza. What I want to do, I want to do something that has my fingerprint on it. So I took a recipe that is from my family from really a long time. It's over like 80 years old. And I transformed that in something that you guys can enjoy it and pick up by slice. We do the dough by hand. So there's no yeast. There is a starter that is 62 years old, and on Valentine's Day it's gonna turn 63. So happy birthday! And there's no machine in the house. It's everything is man powered. So the dough is mixed by hand in the wooden bin. It's been used in my family and in Naples for a generation, and we used to make bread because I come from a family of bread maker and chefs. My mom was a chef. My grandfather was a pastry chef, and my auntie, which taught me how to do bread. Because I'm a bread maker before to be pizza chef. Mm-hmm. So she taught me about bread and panification and everything.
Okay, and you are going to be talking, you're going to be making a date pizza. Can you tell us more about that?
So what we do, you know, I love dates. You know, they're sweet, you know, and not refined. And you guys just got the little dates in the morning and your day always is better, right? What I found at the farmer's market, I met these sweet guys and dates by Dual. And, you know, I didn't know that much about dates. But what I do, I'm curious all the time. So I ask questions like there is no tomorrow. So I ask a lot of questions. So this guy came, you know, okay, wait, you want to know about this? So he told me the story of each date, and I was on sugar high for I don't know how much time, but I enjoyed, you know. He told me like a Bari date that is super soft and super sweet, and then there is the Medjool date, it's semi-soft, and this is what I use at Pizzana. You know, we macerate a little bit the dates to create a little bit of sauce, and then we chop that up somehow because I like the chunk and the burst of sweetness that comes on the pizza on each bite, and we use that as a base. Then we put butternut squash, which we roast quickly in the wood-burning oven, and we season salt and pepper, and then we use goat cheese, which is, you know, funky and, you know, salty. And then we top it out with a little bit of fior di latte that we import from Naples. Fior di latte is a cheese that is, you know, has less moisture. So when you cook the pizza, you don't have the soggy crust, you know, nobody wants it. So we use the fior di latte, and then when the pizza is coming out, we use the fresh radicchio with a little bit of, you know, aged balsamic, and we just serve the pizza over there. It's, you know, date sweet, there's a butternut squash, it's semi-sweet, the goat cheese is funky, and the bitterness of the radicchio, you know, it's a good pie.
How many slices in this pie?
Six.
Uh-huh.
But you're going to fight over people to eat it.
Okay. Now, the medjool date, you said it's a medium moist, not too moist, not too dry. You get them, you seed them, you chop them. There's a lot of work.
Yeah, well, what we do, we just, you know, I mean, we peat it, and then we save them, the flesh, and then we macerate a little bit. We put it in a pot, and, you know, with a little bit of brown sugar, just a sprinkle to help them to break down. And then it's almost like making a marmalade, a jam. Right, but not cooking all the way through. Just wait that they fall apart a little bit, and then we save some medjool dates on the side that we chop that up really, really finely, and we mix it together. So we use it as a dollop on a pizza, almost as a base, and then we put the other ingredient on top because I have to preserve the dates on the bottom, because otherwise the direct contact with the fire, the wood burning oven, will burn that. You're gonna have a burnt taste and you don't really want it on a pizza.
All right, thank you so much. That was Chef Daniele Uditi. He is chef owner of Pizzana. Sounds like a absolutely delicious pizza place in Brentwood. And we're going to be celebrating 63-year-old sourdough starter on Valentine's Day. Thank you so much, chef.
Thank you. Goodbye, guys.
I'm visiting now with Everett Duvall. He is one of the three date farmers who comes weekly to the Santa Monica Farmers Markets. And Everett, you are in Thermal. Where is your date farm located?
Indio.
Yeah, so you're all out in Coachella Valley, basically.
Right.
All dates are grown basically in one area in California. You've been out there how many years?
We got the ranch in 1970.
Okay, and how long have dates been grown out there in California?
Well, I think they started them, they came from Africa, the Deglet Noor varieties, the one that came from Africa, and they only would let the Deglet Noor in. And then Morocco went and sent five shoots to the United States, and that's when they started the Medjool variety. So they had an area in Arizona and Nevada. Mm-hmm. And In 1935, they started bringing them into California, and they have probably, I would say, 50% of the medjools now are being harvested in Coachella Valley.
And they're unique to that area because of the climate?
Yes. The dates are known. You got to have the dates, their feet in their water and their head in the sun. And that's what it gets down there, is plenty of sun.
Okay, but you have to irrigate.
Yes, we do irrigate. In 1918, they built a canal from the Colorado River. My ranch gets canal water, and then I have a well that pumps water out of it. It's a 40-horse pump, probably, I would say, 600 or 700 gallons a minute.
I know the desert now is where a lot of people are moving. Is there some pressure now on ag land out there with the houses?
Well, that's why we're going to Desert Center. Land is very expensive. You couldn't farm it with what they're asking for. In 1970, who'd ever dream that there would be a Coachella Fest?
Yes, that's become huge. So growing dates, you've got to go up and down the tree several times. Yes. Before you can actually pick the dates, right?
Well, what happens is we got to pollinate them March and April. Mm-hmm. And when we pollinate in March and April, we have to go over the grove twice a week to pollinate, because you take the pollen from the male tree and put it in the female tree. And one male tree will produce enough pollen for 40 female trees.
As long as they're close together. But it's not wind-carried. You hand-pollinate.
You have to do it all by hand.
So on an average tree on your honeys, how many times is that tree going to be climbed till you finally harvest?
Probably 10 times.
Wow, it's very labor-intensive, it sounds like. Yeah, and you're out there in the heat, no doubt. So thank you, Everett. Thank you for being a farmer.
Thank you.
That was Everett Duvall. He's a multi-generation date farmer from Indio, California, and he brings in two varieties that no one else grows, the honey and the TR, in addition to his daiglets and his medjools and his barhees. For The Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
And finally, here's our favorite food critic, Jonathan Gold, with a restaurant recommendation. I hear today we're going a bit farther afield than usual.
We're going to Newport Beach, or the ritzy section of Newport Beach.
That's quite unusual.
It is. I don't think we've talked about a restaurant there for a few years.
Maybe since we talked about the restaurant that this place is replacing.
Right, that great Indian restaurant, Tamarind.
Which is now?
Marché Moderne. Which we've talked about in its old location in the South Coast Plaza. It was always kind of like one of the best things about South Coast Plaza, right? You could shop and then you were overwhelmed by all the luxuriousness and you took the stairs up and you could get like a perfect niçoise salad. But Amelia and Florent Marnot, who like owned and were the chef of the restaurant in South Coast Plaza, have moved it to the Crystal Cove area of Newport Beach. And it's like one of those completely Newport Beach restaurants. You know, where you see, like, fashions you don't see anywhere else but, like, coastal Orange County.
Pastel colors, fluttery, bodycon dresses.
But bodycon and in some way also billowy. I don't even know how you would design a dress like that, but...
On very fit bodies.
So fit. But not so fit that they will not go in for a terrine and a slice of apple tart.
That's wonderful. That makes me so happy. So the style of this kind of restaurant is like very luxurious. There's space. You're sitting on a nice chair or a nice banquette.
The music is not like the blasting EDM that so many restaurants have. I don't even know what kind of music it is, but it's just way in the back. You hardly notice it. And it's loud enough to be buzzy, but it's not overwhelming, which is nice.
So let's talk about the food. What was the dish that blew you away?
Is it hard to tell? I mean, I love the roasted marrow bones, which were just the regular marrow bones, you know, sawed in half and roasted, but they were like perfectly done. They weren't either like melting into grease or so solid that it was unpleasant to eat. There was a really nice, thick, winey demi-glace with them. It was super pleasant. I really liked the hanger steak, which was just a hanger steak, but a really nice quality one with some age on it. It was Is hanger steak one of the cuts that you like?
I love hanger steak. And I use it in so many different ways. I love the flavor that it has. It has a kind of iodine-y tang. It tastes like meat.
It tastes a lot like meat. I mean, it's up there. It's like tucked next to the kidneys in the body of the cow, right?
Mm-hmm.
But so often, especially when you get it in restaurants, they overcook it. And when you overcook it even like a second, it becomes not good. Their hanger steak was just magnificent. It had that, you know, super strong, almost livery but not livery flavor to it. It had a really nice char on it. And it was that perfect sort of purpley pink inside. It was one of my favorite steaks that I've had in a while. It was like sort of the last place I would have expected to have seen it.
And then did you have something sort of more old school French?
Yeah, most of the stuff is old school French here. I mean, you can always find foie gras, for example. I mean, either like, you know, a lovely terrine with preserved cherries, a little bit of gingerbread underneath, and maybe a dusting of Sichuan pepper, which is to say a little bit updated, but not so much that you wouldn't see it on a French restaurant in, you know, France. Or sautéed foie gras on a chunk of bread topped with, like, turnip pickles. And I guess it was a sauce. It was a bunch of super buttery, velvety pureed parsnips. That was nice. One of the best dishes there is a braised rabbit, basically, with a mustard sauce, with chunky handmade noodles served in a copper pot. There's this thing on the menu now that like lists the date and the restaurant in which certain dishes were originated.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah. I mean, Marnot has cooked in a lot of Luke's Orange County restaurants over the years. So that one comes from the restaurant Pascal in 1991. There's a lovely smoked duck breast with honey and turnips from the restaurant Aubergine, which was probably the best French restaurant in Orange County in the mid-90s. There's charred octopus with this pureed Spanish chorizo. It's a funky sauce, but it's also suave and buttery.
And what about the coq au vin?
The coq au vin there is great. It may be my favorite one in town at the moment, though there are some others that are up there. The sauce, it's cooked down to this like super coating thickness, and it tastes completely of wine, and yet it tastes completely of chicken. There's a ton of lardon in there. The mushrooms have given their body to the sauce, and there's this like lovely oniony thing going on. Coq au vin is something I like to make at home, and I've never managed to have a depth of a reduction the way that he has there.
You should ask him for her tips.
It would probably work.
Well, this is nice. I bet people will actually get on the road and drive down there.
Maybe they should.
Well, thank you so much, Jonathan.
So glad to be here, Evan.
That is it for this week's show. Before we go, I want to tell you about a special event I'm going to be part of later this month. Join me on Tuesday, February 27th at Melody in Virgil Village for a pop-up celebrating knedel or dumplings. I'll be serving up my own interpretation of a matzo ball. All proceeds go to Mary's List. Get info and tickets by emailing matzoball@icloud.com or visit Good Food's Facebook page. If you missed any part of this week's show, listen to it on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can always find us on Apple Podcasts. Many thanks to the Good Team. I am Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.